And still, like the moon and its light and the shadows. Prince Andrei, too, dared not stir for fear of betraying his unintentional presence.
"Sonya! Sonya!" he again heard the first speaker. "Oh, how can you sleep? Only look how glorious it is! Ah, oh, how glorious! Do wake up, Sonya!" she said almost with tears in her voice. "There never, never was such a lovely night before."
Sonya made some reluctant reply.
"Do just come and see what a moon! Oh, how lovely! Come here, darling sweetheart, come here. There, you see? I feel like sitting down on my heels, putting my arms round my knees like this, straining tight as possible, and flying away like this.
Take care, you'll fall out." He heard the sound of a scuffle and Sonya's disapproving voice. "It's past 1 o'clock.
"Oh, you only spoil things for me. All right, go, go."
Again all was silent, but Prince Andrei knew she was still sitting there. From time to time he heard a soft rustle, and at times a sigh.
Oh, God, what does it mean?" she suddenly exclaimed. "To bed, then, if it must be."
And she slammed the casement. "For her, I might as well not exist," thought Prince Andrei, while he listened to her voice, for some reason expecting, yet fearing, that she might say something about him. "There she is again, as if it were on purpose," thought he. In his soul there suddenly arose such an unexpected turmoil of youthful thoughts and hopes, contrary to the whole tenor of his life, that unable to explain his condition to himself, he lay down and fell asleep at once. Chapter 3. The Return Through the Forest. Next morning, having taken leave of no one but the Count, and not waiting for the ladies to appear, Prince Andrei set off for home. It was already the beginning of June when on his return journey he drove into the birch forest where the gnarled old oak had made so strange and memorable an impression on him. In the forest the harness bells sounded yet more muffled than they had done 6 weeks before, for now all was thick, shady, and dense, and the young firs dotted about in the forest did not jar on the general beauty, but lending themselves to the mood around, were delicately green with fluffy young shoots. The whole day had been hot. Somewhere a storm was gathering, but only a small cloud had scattered some raindrops lightly, sprinkling the road and the sappy leaves. The left side of the forest was dark in the shade, the right side glittered in the sunlight, wet and shiny and scarcely swayed by the breeze. Everything was in blossom, the nightingales trilled, and their voices reverberated now near, now far away. "Yes, here in this forest was that oak with which I agreed," thought Prince Andrei. "But where is it?" he again wondered, gazing at the left side of the road, and without recognizing it he looked with admiration at the very oak he sought. The old oak, quite transfigured, spreading out a canopy of sappy dark green foliage, stood wrapped and slightly trembling in the rays of the evening sun. Neither gnarled fingers, nor old scars, nor old doubts and sorrows were any of them in evidence now. Through the hard, century-old bark, even where there were no twigs, leaves had sprouted such as one could hardly believe the old veteran could have produced. "Yes, it is the same oak," thought Prince Andrei, and all at once he was seized by an unreasoning springtime feeling of joy and renewal. All the best moments of his life suddenly rose to his memory. Austerlitz with the lofty heavens, his wife's dead reproachful face, Pierre at the ferry, that girl thrilled by the beauty of the night, and that night itself and the moon, and all this rushed suddenly to his mind. "No, life is not over at 31, Prince Andrei suddenly decided finally and decisively. "It is not enough for me to know what I have in me. Everyone must know it. Pierre, and that young girl who wanted to fly away into the sky, everyone must know me, so that my life may not be lived for myself alone, while others live so apart from it, but so that it may be reflected in them all, and that they and I may live in harmony. On reaching home, Prince Andrei decided to go to Petersburg that autumn, and found all sorts of reasons for this decision. A whole series of sensible and logical considerations, showing it to be essential for him to go to Petersburg and even to re-enter the service, kept springing up in his mind. He could not now understand how he could ever even have doubted the necessity of taking an active share in life, just as a month before he had not understood how the idea of leaving the quiet country could ever enter his head. It now seemed clear to him that all his experience of life must be senselessly wasted unless he applied it to some kind of work and again played an active part in life. He did not even remember how formerly, on the strength of similar wretched logical arguments, it had seemed obvious that he would be degrading himself if he now, after the lessons he had had in life, allowed himself to believe in the possibility of being useful and in the possibility of happiness or love. Now, reason suggested quite the opposite. After that journey to Ryazan, he found the country dull. His former pursuits no longer interested him, and often when sitting alone in his study he got up, went to the mirror, and gazed a long time at his own face. Then he would turn away to the portrait of his dead Lisa, who, with hair curled à la grecque, looked tenderly and gaily at him out of the gilt frame. She did not now say those former terrible words to him, but looked simply, merrily, and inquisitively at him. And Prince Andrei, crossing his arms behind him, long paced the room, now frowning, now smiling, as he reflected on those irrational, inexpressible thoughts, secret as a crime, which altered his whole life and were connected with Pierre, with fame, with the girl at the window, the oak, and woman's beauty and love. And if anyone came into his room at such moments, he was particularly cold, stern, and above all, unpleasantly logical.
"My dear," Princess Maria, entering at such a moment, would say, "little Nikolai can't go out today. It's very cold."
"If it were hot," Prince Andrei would reply at such times very dryly to his sister, "he could go out in his smock, but as it is cold, he must wear warm clothes which were designed for that purpose. That is what follows from the fact that it is cold, and not that a child who needs fresh air should remain at home," he would add with extreme logic, as if punishing someone for those secret, illogical emotions that stirred within him. At such moments, Princess Maria would think how intellectual work dries men up. Chapter 4. Speransky, Arakcheyev, and Prince Andrei. Prince Andrei arrived in Petersburg in August 1809. It was the time when the youthful Speransky was at the zenith of his fame and his reforms were being pushed forward with the greatest energy. That same August the Emperor was thrown from his calèche, injured his leg, and remained 3 weeks at Peterhof, receiving Speransky every day and no one else. At that time the two famous decrees were being prepared that so agitated society, abolishing court ranks and introducing examinations to qualify for the grades of collegiate assessor and state councillor. And not merely these, but a whole state constitution intended to change the existing order of government in Russia, legal, administrative, and financial, from the Council of State down to the district tribunals. Now those vague liberal dreams with which the Emperor Alexander had ascended the throne, and which he had tried to put into effect with the aid of his associates Chartoryski, Novosiltsev, Kochubey, and Stroganov, whom he himself in jest had called his Comité de Salut Public, were taking shape and being realized. Now all these men were replaced by Speransky on the civil side and Arakcheyev on the military. Soon after his arrival, Prince Andrei, as a gentleman of the chamber, presented himself at court and at a levee. The Emperor, though he met him twice, did not favour him with a single word. It had always seemed to Prince Andrei before that he was antipathetic to the Emperor, and that the latter disliked his face and personality generally, and in the cold, repellent glance the Emperor gave him, he now found further confirmation of this surmise. The courtiers explained the Emperor's neglect of him by His Majesty's displeasure at Bolkonski's not having served since 1805. "I know myself that one cannot help one's sympathies and antipathies," thought Prince Andrei, "so it will not do to present my proposal for the reform of the army regulations to the Emperor personally, but the project will speak for itself." He mentioned what he had written to an old field marshal, a friend of his father's. The field marshal made an appointment to see him, received him graciously, and promised to inform the Emperor. A few days later, Prince Andrei received notice that he was to go to see the Minister of War, Count Arakcheyev. On the appointed day, Prince Andrei entered Count Arakcheyev's waiting room at 9 in the morning. He did not know Arakcheyev personally, had never seen him, and all he had heard of him inspired him with but little respect for the man. "He is Minister of War, a man trusted by the Emperor, and I need not concern myself about his personal qualities. He has been commissioned to consider my project, so he alone can get it adopted," thought Prince Andrei as he waited among a number of important and unimportant people in Count Arakcheyev's waiting room. During his service, chiefly as an adjutant, Prince Andrei had seen the anterooms of many important men, and the different types of such rooms were well known to him. Count Arakcheyev's anteroom had quite a special character. The faces of the unimportant people awaiting their turn for an audience showed embarrassment and servility. The faces of those of higher rank expressed a common feeling of awkwardness, covered by a mask of unconcern and ridicule of themselves, their situation, and the person for whom they were waiting. Some walked thoughtfully up and down, others whispered and laughed. Prince Andrei heard the nickname Sila Andreevich and the words, "Uncle will give it to us hot," in reference to Count Arakcheyev. One general, an important personage, evidently feeling offended at having to wait so long, sat crossing and uncrossing his legs and smiling contemptuously to himself. But the moment the door opened, one feeling alone appeared on all faces, that of fear. Prince Andrei, for the second time, asked the adjutant on duty to take in his name, but received an ironical look and was told that his turn would come in due course. After some others had been shown in and out of the minister's room by the adjutant on duty, an officer who struck Prince Andrei by his humiliated and frightened air was admitted at that terrible door. This officer's audience lasted a long time. Then, suddenly, the grating sound of a harsh voice was heard from the other side of the door, and the officer, with pale face and trembling lips, came out and passed through the waiting room, clutching his head. After this, Prince Andrei was conducted to the door, and the officer on duty said in a whisper, "To the right, at the window." Prince Andrei entered a plain, tidy room, and saw at the table a man of 40 with a long waist, a long, closely cropped head, deep wrinkles, scowling brows above dull, greenish-hazel eyes, and an overhanging red nose. Arakcheyev turned his head toward him without looking at him.
"What is your petition?" asked Arakcheyev.
"I am not petitioning, Your Excellency," returned Prince Andrei quietly. Arakcheyev's eyes turned toward him.
"Sit down," said he. "Prince Bolkonski?"
"I am not petitioning about anything. His Majesty the Emperor has deigned to send Your Excellency a project submitted by me."
"You see, my dear sir, I have read your project,"
interrupted Arakcheyev, uttering only the first words amiably, and then, again without looking at Prince Andrei, relapsing gradually into a tone of grumbling contempt.
"You are proposing new military laws? There are many laws, but no one to carry out the old ones. Nowadays everybody designs laws. It is easier writing than doing."
"I came at His Majesty the Emperor's wish to learn from your excellency how you propose to deal with the memorandum I have presented," said Prince Andrei politely.
"I have endorsed a resolution on your memorandum and sent it to the committee. I do not approve of it," said Arakcheyev, rising and taking a paper from his writing table.
"Here,"
and he handed it to Prince Andrei. Across the paper was scrawled in pencil, without capital letters, misspelt and without punctuation,
"Unsoundly constructed, because resembles an imitation of the French military code and from the articles of war needlessly deviating."
"To what committee has the memorandum been referred?" inquired Prince Andrei.
"To the Committee on Army Regulations, and I have recommended that Your Honour should be appointed a member, but without a salary."
Prince Andrei smiled. "I don't want one."
"A member without salary," repeated Arakcheyev. "I have the honour, eh? Call the next one. Who else is there?" he shouted, bowing to Prince Andrei.
Chapter 5. While waiting for the announcement of his appointment to the committee, Prince Andrei looked up his former acquaintances, particularly those he knew to be in power and whose aid he might need. In Petersburg he now experienced the same feeling he had had on the eve of a battle, when troubled by anxious curiosity and irresistibly attracted to the ruling circles where the future, on which the fate of millions depended, was being shaped. From the irritation of the older men, the curiosity of the uninitiated, the reserve of the initiated, the hurry and preoccupation of everyone, and the innumerable committees and commissions of whose existence he learned every day, he felt that now, in 1809, here in Petersburg, a vast civil conflict was in preparation, the commander-in-chief of which was a mysterious person he did not know, but who was supposed to be a man of genius, Speransky. And this movement of reconstruction, of which Prince Andrei had a vague idea, and Speransky, its chief promoter, began to interest him so keenly that the question of the army regulations quickly receded to a secondary place in his consciousness. Prince Andrei was most favourably placed to secure good reception in the highest and most diverse Petersburg circles of the day. The reforming party cordially welcomed and courted him, in the first place because he was reputed to be clever and very well read, and secondly because by liberating his serfs he had obtained the reputation of being a liberal. The party of the old and dissatisfied, who censured the innovations, turned to him expecting his sympathy in their disapproval of the reforms, simply because he was the son of his father. The feminine society world welcomed him gladly, because he was rich, distinguished, a good match, and almost a newcomer, with a halo of romance on account of his supposed death and the tragic loss of his wife. Besides this, the general opinion of all who had known him previously was that he had greatly improved during these last 5 years, having softened and grown more manly, lost his former affectation, pride, and contemptuous irony, and acquired the serenity that comes with years. People talked about him, were interested in him, and wanted to meet him. The day after his interview with Count Arakcheyev, Prince Andrei spent the evening at Count Kotchubey's. He told the Count of his interview with Strongman Andreevich. Kotchubey spoke of Arakcheyev by that nickname, with the same vague irony Prince Andrei had noticed in the Minister of War's anteroom.
"Mon cher, even in this case you can't do without Mikhail Mikhailovich Speransky. He manages everything. I'll speak to him. He has promised to come this evening."
"What has Speransky to do with the army regulations?" asked Prince Andrei. Kotchubey shook his head smilingly, as if surprised at Bolkonsky's simplicity.
"We were talking to him about you a few days ago," Kotchubey continued, "and about your freed ploughman."
"Oh, is it you, Prince, who have freed your serfs?" said an old man of Catherine's day, turning contemptuously towards Bolkonsky.
"It was a small estate that brought in no profit," replied Prince Andrei, trying to extenuate his action so as not to irritate the old man uselessly.
"Afraid of being late," said the old man, looking at Kotchubey. "There's one thing I don't understand," he continued. "Who will plough the land if they're set free? It is easy to write laws, but difficult to rule. Just the same as now. I ask you, Count, who will be heads of the departments when everybody has to pass examinations?"
"Those who pass the examinations, I suppose," replied Kochubei, crossing his legs and glancing round.
"Well, I have Pryanichnikov serving under me, a splendid man, a priceless man, but he's 60. Is he to go up for examination?"
"Yes, that's a difficulty, as education is not at all general, but—"
Count Kochubei did not finish. He rose, took Prince Andrei by the arm, and went to meet a tall, bald, fair man of about 40, with a large, open forehead and a long face of unusual and peculiar whiteness, who was just entering. The newcomer wore a blue swallowtail coat with a cross suspended from his neck and a star on his left breast. It was Speransky. Prince Andrei recognized him at once and felt a throb within him, as happens at critical moments of life. Whether it was from respect, envy, or anticipation, he did not know. Speransky's whole figure was of a peculiar type that made him easily recognizable. In the society in which Prince Andrei lived, he had never seen anyone who, together with awkward and clumsy gestures, possessed such calmness and self-assurance. He had never seen so resolute yet gentle an expression as that in those half-closed, rather humid eyes, or so firm a smile that expressed nothing. Nor had he heard such a refined, smooth, soft voice. Above all, he had never seen such delicate whiteness of face or hands, hands which were broad but very plump, soft, and white. Such whiteness and softness Prince Andrei had only seen on the faces of soldiers who had been long in hospital. This was Speransky, Secretary of State, reporter to the Emperor, and his companion at Erfurt, where he had more than once met and talked with Napoleon. Speransky did not shift his eyes from one face to another, as people involuntarily do on entering a large company, and was in no hurry to speak. He spoke slowly, with assurance that he would be listened to, and he looked only at the person with whom he was conversing. Prince Andrei followed Speransky's every word and movement with particular attention. As happens to some people, especially to men who judge those near to them severely, he always, on meeting anyone new, especially anyone whom, like Speransky, he knew by reputation, expected to discover in him the perfection of human qualities. Speransky told Kochubei he was sorry he had been unable to come sooner, as he had been detained at the palace. He did not say that the Emperor had kept him, and Prince Andrei noticed this affectation of modesty. When Kochubei introduced Prince Andrei, Speransky slowly turned his eyes to Bolkonski with his customary smile and looked at him in silence.
"I am very glad to make your acquaintance. I had heard of you, as everyone has," he said after a pause.
Kochubei said a few words about the reception Arakcheyev had given Bolkonski. Speransky smiled more markedly.
"The chairman of the Committee on Army Regulations is my good friend, Monsieur Magnitsky," he said, fully articulating every word and syllable, "and if you like I can put you in touch with him."
He paused at the full stop.
"I hope you will find him sympathetic and ready to cooperate in promoting all that is reasonable."
A circle soon formed round Speransky, and the old man who had talked about his subordinate, Pryanichnikov, addressed a question to him. Prince Andrei, without joining in the conversation, watched every movement of Speransky's. This man, not long since an insignificant divinity student, who now, Bolkonski thought, held in his hands, those plump white hands, the fate of Russia. Prince Andrei was struck by the extraordinarily disdainful composure with which Speransky answered the old man. He appeared to address condescending words to him from an immeasurable height. When the old man began to speak too loud, Speransky smiled and said he could not judge of the advantage or disadvantage of what pleased the sovereign. Having talked for a little while in the general circle, Speransky rose and, coming up to Prince Andrei, took him along to the other end of the room. It was clear that he thought it necessary to interest himself in Bolkonski.
"I had no chance to talk with you, Prince, during the animated conversation in which that venerable gentleman involved me," he said with a mildly contemptuous smile, as if intimating by that smile that he and Prince Andrei understood the insignificance of the people with whom he had just been talking. This flattered Prince Andrei. "I have known of you for a long time, first from your action with regard to your serfs, a first example, of which it is very desirable that there should be more imitators, and secondly, because you are one of those gentlemen of the chamber who have not considered themselves offended by the new decree concerning the ranks allotted to courtiers, which is causing so much gossip and tittle-tattle."
"No," said Prince Andrei. "My father did not wish me to take advantage of the privilege. I began the service from the lower grade."
"Your father, a man of the last century, evidently stands above our contemporaries, who so condemn this measure which merely re-establishes natural justice."
"I think, however, that these condemnations have some ground," returned Prince Andrei, trying to resist Speransky's influence, of which he began to be conscious. He did not like to agree with him in everything, and felt a wish to contradict. Though he usually spoke easily and well, he felt a difficulty in expressing himself now while talking with Speransky. He was too much absorbed in observing the famous man's personality.
"Grounds of personal ambition, maybe," Speransky put in quietly.
"And of state interest, to some extent," said Prince Andrei.
"What do you mean?" asked Speransky quietly, lowering his eyes.
"I am an admirer of Montesquieu," replied Prince Andrei in French, "and his idea that the principle of monarchies is honour seems to me incontestable. Certain rights and privileges for the aristocracy appear to me a means of maintaining that sentiment."
The smile vanished from Speransky's white face, which was much improved by the change. Probably Prince Andrei's thought interested him.
"If you regard the question from that point of view," he began, pronouncing French with evident difficulty and speaking even slower than in Russian, but quite calmly.
Speransky went on to say that honour, l'honneur, cannot be upheld by privileges harmful to the service, that honour, l'honneur, is either a negative concept of not doing what is blameworthy, or it is a source of emulation in pursuit of commendation and rewards, which recognise it. His arguments were concise, simple, and clear.
"An institution upholding honour, the source of emulation, is one similar to the Légion d'honneur of the great Emperor Napoleon, not harmful but helpful to the success of the service, but not a class or court privilege."
"I do not dispute that, but it cannot be denied that court privileges have attained the same end," returned Prince Andrei. "Every courtier considers himself bound to maintain his position worthily."
"Yet you do not care to avail yourself of the privilege, Prince," said Speransky, indicating by a smile that he wished to finish amiably an argument which was embarrassing for his companion. "If you will do me the honour of calling on me on Wednesday," he added, "I will, after talking with Magnitsky, let you know what may interest you, and shall also have the pleasure of a more detailed chat with you."
Closing his eyes, he bowed à la française, without taking leave, and trying to attract as little attention as possible, he left the room. Chapter 6. During the first weeks of his stay in Petersburg, Prince Andrei felt the whole trend of thought he had formed during his life of seclusion quite overshadowed by the trifling cares that engrossed him in that city. On returning home in the evening, he would jot down in his notebook 4 or 5 necessary calls or appointments for certain hours. The mechanism of life, the arrangement of the day so as to be in time everywhere, absorbed the greater part of his vital energy.
He did nothing, did not even think or find time to think, but only talked, and talked successfully, of what he had thought while in the country. He sometimes noticed with dissatisfaction that he repeated the same remark on the same day in different circles, but he was so busy for whole days together that he had no time to notice that he was thinking of nothing. As he had done on their first meeting at Kochubey's, Speransky produced a strong impression on Prince Andrei on the Wednesday, when he received him tête-à-tête at his own house and talked to him long and confidentially. To Bolkonski, so many people appeared contemptible and insignificant creatures, and he so longed to find in someone the living ideal of that perfection toward which he strove, that he readily believed that in Speransky he had found this ideal of a perfectly rational and virtuous man. Had Speransky sprung from the same class as himself and possessed the same breeding and traditions, Bolkonski would soon have discovered his weak, human, unheroic sides. But as it was, Speransky's strange and logical turn of mind inspired him with respect all the more because he did not quite understand him. Moreover, Speransky, either because he appreciated the other's capacity or because he considered it necessary to win him to his side, showed off his dispassionate, calm reasonableness before Prince Andrei and flattered him with that subtle flattery which goes hand in hand with self-assurance and consists in a tacit assumption that one's companion is the only man besides oneself capable of understanding the folly of the rest of mankind and the reasonableness and profundity of one's own ideas. During their long conversation on Wednesday evening, Speransky more than once remarked, "We regard everything that is above the common level of rooted custom," or with a smile, "but we want the wolves to be fed and the sheep to be safe," or, "They cannot understand this," and all in a way that seemed to say, "We, you and I, understand what they are and who we are." This first long conversation with Speransky only strengthened in Prince Andrei the feeling he had experienced toward him at their first meeting. He saw in him a remarkable, clear-thinking man of vast intellect, who by his energy and persistence had attained power, which he was using solely for the welfare of Russia. In Prince Andrei's eyes, Speransky was the man he would himself have wished to be, one who explained all the facts of life reasonably, considered important only what was rational, and was capable of applying the standard of reason to everything. Everything seemed so simple and clear in Speransky's exposition that Prince Andrei involuntarily agreed with him about everything. If he replied and argued, it was only because he wished to maintain his independence and not submit to Speransky's opinions entirely. Everything was right, and everything was as it should be. Only one thing disconcerted Prince Andrei. This was Speransky's cold, mirror-like look, which did not allow one to penetrate to his soul, and his delicate white hands, which Prince Andrei involuntarily watched, as one does watch the hands of those who possess power. This mirror-like gaze and those delicate hands irritated Prince Andrei. He knew not why. He was unpleasantly struck, too, by the excessive contempt for others that he observed in Speransky, and by the diversity of lines of argument he used to support his opinions. He made use of every kind of mental device except analogy, and passed too boldly, it seemed to Prince Andrei, from one to another. Now he would take up the position of a practical man and condemn dreamers, now that of a satirist and laugh ironically at his opponents, now grow severely logical or suddenly rise to the realm of metaphysics. This last resource was one he very frequently employed. He would transfer a question to metaphysical heights, pass on to definitions of space, time, and thought, and having deduced the refutation he needed, would again descend to the level of the original discussion. In general, the trait of Speransky's mentality which struck Prince Andrei most was his absolute and unshakable belief in the power and authority of reason.
It was evident that the thought could never occur to him, which to Prince Andrei seemed so natural, namely, that it is after all impossible to express all one thinks, and that he had never felt the doubt, "Is not all I think and believe nonsense?" And it was just this peculiarity of Speransky's mind that particularly attracted Prince Andrei. During the first period of their acquaintance, Bolkonski felt a passionate admiration for him, similar to that which he had once felt for Bonaparte. The fact that Speransky was the son of a village priest, and that stupid people might meanly despise him on account of his humble origin, as in fact many did, caused Prince Andrei to cherish his sentiment for him the more, and unconsciously to strengthen it. On that first evening Bolkonski spent with him, having mentioned the commission for the revision of the Code of Laws, Speransky told him sarcastically that the commission had existed for 150 years, had cost millions, and had done nothing except that Rosenkampf had stuck labels on the corresponding paragraphs of the different codes. "And that is all the state has for the millions it has spent," said he. "We want to give the Senate new juridical powers, but we have no laws. That is why it is a sin for men like you, Prince, not to serve in these times." Prince Andrei said that for that work an education in jurisprudence was needed, which he did not possess. "But nobody possesses it, so what would you have? It is a vicious circle from which we must break a way out." A week later, Prince Andrei was a member of the Committee on Army Regulations, and, what he had not at all expected, was chairman of a section of the Committee for the Revision of the Laws. At Speransky's request, he took the first part of the civil code that was being drawn up, and, with the aid of the Code Napoleon and the Institutes of Justinian, he worked at formulating the section on personal rights. Chapter 7. Pierre and the Petersburg Freemasons. Nearly 2 years before this, in 1808, Pierre, on returning to Petersburg after visiting his estates, had involuntarily found himself in a leading position among the Petersburg Freemasons. He arranged dining and funeral lodge meetings, enrolled new members, and busied himself uniting various lodges and acquiring authentic charters. He gave money for the erection of temples and supplemented, as far as he could, the collection of arms, in regard to which the majority of members were stingy and irregular. He supported almost single-handed a poorhouse the order had founded in Petersburg. His life, meanwhile, continued as before, with the same infatuations and dissipations. He liked to dine and drink well, and though he considered it immoral and humiliating, could not resist the temptations of the bachelor circles in which he moved. Amid the turmoil of his activities and distractions, however, Pierre, at the end of a year, began to feel that the more firmly he tried to rest upon it, the more the Masonic ground on which he stood gave way under him. At the same time, he felt that the deeper the ground sank under him, the closer bound he involuntarily became to the order. When he had joined the Freemasons, he had experienced the feeling of one who confidently steps onto the smooth surface of a bog. When he put his foot down, it sank in. To make quite sure of the firmness of the ground, he put his other foot down, and sank deeper still, became stuck in it, and involuntarily waded knee-deep in the bog. Joseph Alexeyevich was not in Petersburg. He had of late stood aside from the affairs of the Petersburg lodges and lived almost entirely in Moscow. All the members of the lodges were men Pierre knew in ordinary life, and it was difficult for him to regard them merely as brothers in Freemasonry and not as Prince B or Ivan Vasilievich D, whom he knew in society mostly as weak and insignificant men. Under the Masonic aprons and the insignia, he saw the uniforms and decorations at which they aimed in ordinary life. Often after collecting arms and reckoning up 20 to 30 rubles received for the most part in promises from a dozen members, of whom half were as well able to pay as himself, Pierre remembered the Masonic vow in which each brother promised to devote all his belongings to his neighbour, and doubts on which he tried not to dwell arose in his soul. He divided the brothers he knew into four categories. In the first, he put those who did not take an active part in the affairs of the lodge, or in human affairs, but were exclusively occupied with the mystical science of the order, with questions of the threefold designation of God, the three primordial elements, sulphur, mercury, and salt, or the meaning of the square and all the various figures of the Temple of Solomon. Pierre respected this class of brothers to which the elder ones chiefly belonged, including, Pierre thought, Joseph Alexeyevich himself, but he did not share their interests. His heart was not in the mystical aspect of Freemasonry. In the second category, Pierre reckoned himself and others like him, seeking and vacillating, who had not yet found in Freemasonry a straight and comprehensible path, but hoped to do so. In the third category, he included those brothers, the majority, who saw nothing in Freemasonry but the external forms and ceremonies, and prized the strict performance of these forms without troubling about their purport or significance. Such were Willarski and even the Grand Master of the Principal Lodge. Finally, to the fourth category also a great many brothers belonged, particularly those who had lately joined. These, according to Pierre's observations, were men who had no belief in anything, nor desire for anything, but joined the Freemasons merely to associate with the wealthy young brothers who were influential through their connections or rank, and of whom there were very many in the lodge. Pierre began to feel dissatisfied with what he was doing. Freemasonry, at any rate as he saw it here, sometimes seemed to him based merely on externals. He did not think of doubting Freemasonry itself, but suspected that Russian Masonry had taken a wrong path and deviated from its original principles. And so toward the end of the year he went abroad to be initiated into the higher secrets of the order. In the summer of 1809, Pierre returned to Petersburg. Our Freemasons knew from correspondence with those abroad that Bezukhov had obtained the confidence of many highly placed persons, had been initiated into many mysteries, had been raised to a higher grade, and was bringing back with him much that might conduce to the advantage of the Masonic cause in Russia. The Petersburg Freemasons all came to see him, tried to ingratiate themselves with him, and it seemed to them all that he was preparing something for them and concealing it. A solemn meeting of the lodge of the second degree was convened, at which Pierre promised to communicate to the Petersburg brothers what he had to deliver to them from the highest leaders of their order. The meeting was a full one. After the usual ceremonies, Pierre rose and began his address. Dear brothers, he began, blushing and stammering, with a written speech in his hand, it is not sufficient to observe our mysteries in the seclusion of our lodge. We must act, act. We are drowsing, but we must act. Pierre raised his notebook and began to read. For the dissemination of pure truth and to secure the triumph of virtue, he read, we must cleanse men from prejudice, diffuse principles in harmony with the spirit of the times, undertake the education of the young, unite ourselves in indissoluble bonds with the wisest men, boldly yet prudently overcome superstitions, infidelity and folly, and form of those devoted to us a body linked together by unity of purpose and possessed of authority and power. To attain this end, we must secure a preponderance of virtue over vice, and must endeavour to secure that the honest man may, even in this world, receive a lasting reward for his virtue. But in these great endeavours, we are gravely hampered by the political institutions of today. What is to be done in these circumstances? To favour revolutions, overthrow everything, repel force by force? No, we are very far from that. Every violent reform deserves censure, for it quite fails to remedy evil, while men remain what they are, and also because wisdom needs no violence. The whole plan of our order should be based on the idea of preparing men of firmness and virtue, bound together by unity of conviction, aiming at the punishment of vice and folly, and patronizing talent and virtue, raising worthy men from the dust, and attaching them to our brotherhood. Only then will our order have the power unobtrusively to bind the hands of the protectors of disorder, and to control them without their being aware of it. In a word, we must found a form of government holding universal sway, which should be diffused over the whole world without destroying the bonds of citizenship, and beside which all other governments can continue in their customary course and do everything except what impedes the great aim of our order, which is to obtain for virtue the victory over vice. This aim was that of Christianity itself. It taught men to be wise and good, and for their own benefit to follow the example and instruction of the best and wisest men. At that time, when everything was plunged in darkness, preaching alone was of course sufficient. The novelty of truth endowed her with special strength. But now we need much more powerful methods. It is now necessary that man, governed by his senses, should find in virtue a charm palpable to those senses. It is impossible to eradicate the passions, but we must strive to direct them to a noble aim, and it is therefore necessary that everyone should be able to satisfy his passions within the limits of virtue. Our order should provide means to that end. As soon as we have a certain number of worthy men in every state, each of them again training two others, and all being closely united, everything will be possible for our order, which has already in secret accomplished much for the welfare of mankind.
This speech not only made a strong impression, but created excitement in the lodge. The majority of the brothers, seeing in it dangerous designs of illuminism, met it with a coldness that surprised Pierre. The Grand Master began answering him, and Pierre began developing his views with more and more warmth. It was long since there had been so stormy a meeting. Parties were formed, some accusing Pierre of illuminism, others supporting him. At that meeting he was struck for the first time by the endless variety of men's minds, which prevents a truth from ever presenting itself identically to two persons. Even those members who seemed to be on his side understood him in their own way, with limitations and alterations he could not agree to, as what he always wanted most was to convey his thought to others just as he himself understood it. At the end of the meeting, the Grand Master, with irony and ill-will, reproved Bezukhov for his vehemence, and said it was not love of virtue alone, but also a love of strife that had moved him in the dispute. Pierre did not answer him, and asked briefly whether his proposal would be accepted. He was told that it would not, and without waiting for the usual formalities, he left the lodge and went home.
Chapter 8. Pierre seeks advice from Joseph Alexeyevich. Again Pierre was overtaken by the depression he so dreaded. For 3 days after the delivery of his speech at the lodge, he lay on a sofa at home, receiving no one and going nowhere. It was just then that he received a letter from his wife, who implored him to see her, telling him how grieved she was about him and how she wished to devote her whole life to him. At the end of the letter, she informed him that in a few days she would return to Petersburg from abroad. Following this letter, one of the Masonic brothers, whom Pierre respected less than the others, forced his way in to see him, and turning the conversation upon Pierre's matrimonial affairs, by way of fraternal advice, expressed the opinion that his severity to his wife was wrong, and that he was neglecting one of the first rules of Freemasonry by not forgiving the penitent. At the same time, his mother-in-law, Prince Vasily's wife, sent to him imploring him to come, if only for a few minutes, to discuss a most important matter. Pierre saw that there was a conspiracy against him, and that they wanted to reunite him with his wife, and in his present mood this was not even unpleasant to him. Nothing mattered to him. Nothing in life seemed to him of much importance, and under the influence of the depression that possessed him, he valued neither his liberty nor his resolution to punish his wife. No one is right, and no one is to blame, so she too is not to blame, he thought. If he did not at once give his consent to a reunion with his wife, it was only because in his state of depression he did not feel able to take any step. Had his wife come to him, he would not have turned her away. Compared to what preoccupied him, was it not a matter of indifference whether he lived with his wife or not? Without replying either to his wife or his mother-in-law, Pierre late one night prepared for a journey and started for Moscow to see Joseph Alexeyevich. This is what he noted in his diary. Moscow, 17th of November. I have just returned from my benefactor and hasten to write down what I have experienced. Joseph Alexeyevich is living poorly and has for 3 years been suffering from a painful disease of the bladder. No one has ever heard him utter a groan or a word of complaint. From morning till late at night, except when he eats his very plain food, he is working at science. He received me graciously and made me sit down on the bed on which he lay. I made the sign of the Knights of the East and of Jerusalem, and he responded in the same manner, asking me with a mild smile what I had learned and gained in the Prussian and Scottish lodges. I told him everything as best I could, and told him what I had proposed to our Petersburg lodge, of the bad reception I had encountered, and of my rupture with the brothers. Joseph Alexeyevich, having remained silent and thoughtful for a good while, told me his view of the matter, which at once lit up for me my whole past and the future path I should follow. He surprised me by asking whether I remembered the threefold aim of the order. 1. The preservation and study of the mystery. 2. The purification and reformation of oneself for its reception. And 3. The improvement of the human race by striving for such purification. Which is the principal aim of these three? Certainly, self-reformation and self-purification. Only to this aim can we always strive independently of circumstances. But at the same time, just this aim demands the greatest efforts of us. And so, led astray by pride, losing sight of this aim, we occupy ourselves either with the mystery which in our impurity we are unworthy to receive, or seek the reformation of the human race while ourselves setting an example of baseness and profligacy. Illuminism is not a pure doctrine, just because it is attracted by social activity and puffed up by pride. On this ground, Joseph Alexeyevich condemned my speech and my whole activity, and in the depth of my soul I agreed with him. Talking of my family affairs, he said to me, "The chief duty of a true Mason, as I have told you, lies in perfecting himself. We often think that by removing all the difficulties of our life, we shall more quickly reach our aim. But on the contrary, my dear sir, it is only in the midst of worldly cares that we can attain our three chief aims. 1. Self-knowledge, for man can only know himself by comparison. 2. Self-perfecting, which can only be attained by conflict. And 3. The attainment of the chief virtue, love of death. Only the vicissitudes of life can show us its vanity and develop our innate love of death or of rebirth to a new life." These words are all the more remarkable because, in spite of his great physical sufferings, Joseph Alexeyevich is never weary of life, though he loves death, for which, in spite of the purity and loftiness of his inner man, he does not yet feel himself sufficiently prepared. My benefactor then explained to me, fully, the meaning of the great square of creation, and pointed out to me that the numbers 3 and 7 are the basis of everything. He advised me not to avoid intercourse with the Petersburg brothers, but to take up only second-grade posts in the lodge, to try, while diverting the brothers from pride, to turn them toward the true path of self-knowledge and self-perfecting. Beside this, he advised me for myself personally, above all, to keep a watch over myself, and to that end he gave me a notebook, the one I am now writing in, and in which I will in future note down all my actions. Petersburg, 23rd of November. I am again living with my wife. My mother-in-law came to me in tears and said that Hélène was here and that she implored me to hear her, that she was innocent and unhappy at my desertion, and much more. I knew that if I once let myself see her, I should not have strength to go on refusing what she wanted. In my perplexity, I did not know whose aid and advice to seek. Had my benefactor been here, he would have told me what to do. I went to my room and re-read Joseph Alexeyevich's letters and recalled my conversations with him, and deduced from it all that I ought not to refuse a suppliant and ought to reach a helping hand to everyone, especially to one so closely bound to me, and that I must bear my cross. But if I forgive her for the sake of doing right, then let union with her have only a spiritual aim. That is what I decided, and what I wrote to Joseph Alexeyevich. I told my wife that I begged her to forget the past, to forgive me whatever wrong I may have done her, and that I had nothing to forgive. It gave me joy to tell her this. She need not know how hard it was for me to see her again. I have settled on the upper floor of this big house, and am experiencing a happy feeling of regeneration. Chapter 9. Hélène's Social Success. At that time, as always happens, the highest society that met at court and at the grand balls was divided into several circles, each with its own particular tone. The largest of these was the French circle of the Napoleonic alliance, the circle of Count Rumyantsev and Caulaincourt. In this group, Hélène, as soon as she had settled in Petersburg with her husband, took a very prominent place. She was visited by the members of the French embassy and by many belonging to that circle, and noted for their intellect and polished manners. Hélène had been at Erfurt during the famous meeting of the emperors and had brought from there these connections with the Napoleonic notabilities. At Erfurt her success had been brilliant. Napoleon himself had noticed her in the theatre and said of her, "C'est un superbe animal." Her success as a beautiful and elegant woman did not surprise Pierre, for she had become even handsomer than before. What did surprise him was that during these last 2 years his wife had succeeded in gaining the reputation d'une femme charmante aussi spirituelle que belle. The distinguished Prince de Ligne wrote her 8-page letters. Bilibin saved up his epigrams to produce them in Countess Bezukhova's presence. To be received in the Countess Bezukhova's salon was regarded as a diploma of intellect. Young men read books before attending Hélène's evenings to have something to say in her salon, and secretaries of the embassy and even ambassadors confided diplomatic secrets to her, so that in a way Hélène was a power. Pierre, who knew she was very stupid, sometimes attended with a strange feeling of perplexity and fear her evenings and dinner parties, where politics, poetry, and philosophy were discussed. At these parties his feelings were like those of a conjurer who always expects his trick to be found out at any moment. But whether because stupidity was just what was needed to run such a salon, or because those who were deceived found pleasure in the deception, at any rate it remained unexposed, and Hélène Bezukhova's reputation as a lovely and clever woman became so firmly established that she could say the emptiest and stupidest things, and everybody would go into raptures over every word of hers and look for a profound meaning in it of which she herself had no conception. Pierre was just the husband needed for a brilliant society woman. He was that absent-minded crank, a grand seigneur husband who was in no one's way, and far from spoiling the high tone and general impression of the drawing-room, he served, by the contrast he presented to her, as an advantageous background to his elegant and tactful wife. Pierre, during the last 2 years, as a result of his continual absorption in abstract interests and his sincere contempt for all else, had acquired in his wife's circle, which did not interest him, that air of unconcern, indifference, and benevolence toward all, which cannot be acquired artificially, and therefore inspires involuntary respect.
He entered his wife's drawing-room as one enters a theatre, was acquainted with everybody, equally pleased to see everyone, and equally indifferent to them all. Sometimes he joined in a conversation which interested him, and regardless of whether any gentlemen of the embassy were present or not, lispingly expressed his views, which were sometimes not at all in accord with the accepted tone of the moment. But the general opinion concerning the queer husband of the most distinguished woman in Petersburg was so well established that no one took his freaks seriously. Among the many young men who frequented her house every day,